From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, the 29th of May, 2009. Education Secretary Arne Duncan details the roadmap for $100 billion in education stimulus funds. Gulf Coast FEMA trailer residents are poised to lose their homes a second time as the agency pushes to evict them. And we'll go to Sri Lanka, where government troops are accused of massacring thousands of civilians in their efforts to crush Tamil Tiger rebels. I'm Ara Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Obama today announced the creation of a special office of cybersecurity at the White House. He says he will personally appoint a cybersecurity coordinator whose duties will be
orchestrating and integrating all cybersecurity policies for the government, working closely with the Office of Management and Budget to ensure agency budgets reflect those priorities, and in the event of major cyber incident or attack, coordinating our response.
The creation of the new advisory position coincides with the release of a U.S. cybersecurity report conducted by former Bush administration advisor Melissa Hathaway. That report includes recommendations on how to secure the U.S. from cyber attacks, which Obama referred to as weapons of mass disruption. The Obama administration has also issued a one-year moratorium on road building and national forests. Most of the forests affected are in the western United States. Oregon environmental groups are pleased with the decision, but they say this is only a first step in reversing harmful Bush administration forestry policies. Rachel McDonald reports from Eugene.
The original Clinton-era rule banned new road construction in more than 58 million acres of remote national forests, but the Bush administration overturned the rule, once again opening up old growth to potential logging. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the one-year moratorium will allow the current administration time to put a long-term roadless policy in place. Sean Stevens with the conservation group Oregon Wild says Vilsack's order is not a total reinstatement of the Clinton-era ban.
We have active projects that are being planned in roadless areas like the debug project on the doorstep of Crater Lake National Park. And so that goes to the secretary, and hopefully the secretary will realize that roadless areas close to Crater Lake shouldn't be logged.
Oregon alone has 2 million acres of national forest that could be protected by the ban. Rachel McDonald, FSRN, Eugene.
Members of the Students of Color Collective at the University of California, Santa Cruz, today entered their fourth day on hunger strike. The students are calling on the school's administration to reverse cuts to campus resources for students of color. The collective began negotiations with the university administration yesterday morning. More than 20 students are participating in the hunger strike. In Britain, the Ministry of Defense has admitted its troops are increasingly using controversial enhanced blast weapons in Afghanistan. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Enhanced blast thermobaric weapons are designed to kill everyone in the buildings they strike. The missile's warhead is made with a mixture of chemicals rather than a simple blast mechanism. The weapons were designed in the US and used in Iraq against so-called non-traditional targets, such as bunkers and caves. While the Geneva Protocol doesn't ban incendiary weapons, it does prohibit them from being used on or near concentrations of civilians. And human rights groups have serious concerns about the effect of such weapons in populated areas. Member of Parliament Nick Harvey called on the Ministry of Defence to ensure enhanced blast weapons are only used as a last resort. Defence Secretary John Hutton said so far this year more than 20 have been fired by pilots of British Apache attack helicopters. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
On June 1st, the Canadian government plans to arm the Canadian Border Service Agency. This is not sitting well with the Akwesasne First Nations, who live along the border between New York and Canada. They say arming the guards violates a treaty dating back to the 18th century. From Canada, FSRN's Amy Miller has more.
Peaceful rallies and a march are planned this weekend on St. Regis Mohawk Reservation to protest the arming of Canada Border Service Agency officers on Native land. These actions come after yesterday's failed attempt by leaders of the Akwesasne First Nations to meet with heads of the CBSA in Ottawa. Chief Larry King told FSRN this latest decision to arm guards is further straining the already difficult relationship between the First Nations and Border Service Agency.
We have historical problems there. That is stolen land. We have presently a file with the Canadian Human Rights Commission of Canada against that particular CBSA facility because of the racial profiling, the harassment, the accosting of our people. Strip searches, young people are labeled and treated very rudely and unfairly. And it's just very, very extremely bad timing on behalf of CBSA, knowing full well all of these issues. And now they want to arm their guards.
The Akwesasne First Nations have promised they will continue to campaign against the arming of the border until the CBSA meets with the community. Amy Miller, FSRN, Montreal.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Secretary of Education Arne Duncan talked to reporters today about the roadmap his department has created for balancing the economic meltdown's toll on education in the United States. Duncan detailed how $100 billion of stimulus money would be distributed, and some are hopeful schools will get the change they need. Sam Greenspan reports from Capitol Hill.
Speaking in Washington, D.C. today, Education Secretary Arne Duncan said the stimulus money for the schools will not be a cure-all for the continued problems in education in this country.
We have never seen that kind of influx in resources. And let me be clear, money is a piece of the answer, but money alone won't begin to solve our problems. And with unprecedented resources, we want to push unprecedented reform. Simply investing the status quo is not going to get us where we need to go. We have to get dramatically better if we're going to retain our spot around the world as the education leader. And the president's drawn a line in the sand. He has said by the year 2020, we want to have the highest percent of college graduates in the world.
President Obama's stimulus plan, which just passed the 100-day mark since it was signed, invested $100 billion into education, an amount unprecedented since the GI Bill, Duncan said. Of these funds, $5 billion will go towards early childhood education and $30 billion towards post-secondary education. The majority of these funds will go to the 95,000 schools serving grades K through 12. Duncan said that he views the dropout rate to be a civil rights issue, and that students whose academic needs are not met by the system face a grim future.
Students that drop out today are basically condemned to poverty and social failure. There are almost no good jobs out there if you simply have a high school diploma. So some form of higher education has to be the aspiration for every single one of our students. It's never been more expensive, and our families have never been under more financial duress. We want to make sure that our fourth and fifth and sixth graders know that even if mom or dad might be losing a job, or might be taking a 30 or 40 or 50% pay cut, we want them to know that money is going to be there for them as they graduate from high school and go on to college. I worry a lot about the dreams of our young people starting to die at an early age if that's not there.
Duncan also mentioned his visit earlier this week to an American Indian reservation in Montana, which faces some of the greatest challenges in terms of education reform in the U.S. Robert Cook, president of the National Indian Education Association and member of the Sioux tribe, commented that he is pleased with the attention that Duncan has given to the American Indian community and is hopeful that the funds will lead to its prosperity.
I think Secretary Duncan understands the needs of children. He understands the needs of communities, that he's making time in the schedule to visit Indian communities and tribal communities. He was out in Billings, Montana, and we understand he visited the Northern Cheyenne Reservation and visited Lame Deer School and also attended the tribal council meeting to listen to some of the different needs of housing. And because of the health care issues that many of our tribal members face, for example, many of our communities are very young. And I know on the Pine Ridge Reservation, where I'm an enrolled member, nearly half of the population is under 21.
Cook said that Duncan does seem to be taking into consideration the special needs of schools on reservations, such as teacher housing in more remote areas, which have fallen into disrepair. Sam Greenspan, FSRN, Washington.
A bill in Texas that would allow those with concealed carry licenses to bring their firearms into college campus buildings is generating opposition from all student and faculty governance bodies at the University of Texas at Austin. UT Austin was the scene of one of the deadliest school shootings in U.S. history. In 1966, architectural engineering student and former Marine Charles Whitman transformed the observation deck of the university's landmark clock tower into a sniper's nest, killing 14 people and wounding 32 others on and near campus. Before classes let out for summer, FSRN's Shannon Young went to the West Mall in front of the tower and asked university body members their opinions on concealed carry on campus.
My name is Danish Sayed, and I am a computer science student, and I'm a senior. I don't think that's a good idea because, I mean, it doesn't have any particular benefit to it, I don't think, and it just doesn't seem like a good idea as in my first instinct.
My name is Catherine Slesher, and I'm a visiting research fellow at the Harry Ransom Center.
Do you think that students should be able to bring concealed firearms into the classrooms? Why or why not?
Absolutely not. I think that's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. Personally, I don't think people should carry firearms anywhere unless there's a specific reason for it, law enforcement or if they're hunters. But I think it's really gotten out of hand in this country. For example, in Spain, where I live, it's illegal to carry firearms. And because of that, we don't have the violent crime that there is in this country. We have purse snatchers and sort of petty crime, but people's lives aren't at risk. I see absolutely no reason on earth why a student would have to carry a firearm.
Colin Harris, government senior. Yes, I think it's a good idea because ultimately it provides better defense in case shootings were to happen, because what it does is it gives law-abiding citizens the right to carry firearms in classrooms. Which I think, if a non-law-abiding citizen were to want to commit a crime on campus, the concealed carry ban doesn't really do anything to stop them because they're already committing a crime and they've proven they have no respect for the law anyway. So why would some sort of statute, a minor, which would be a minor statute to them, you know, why would that impact their crimes?
My name is Bobby Jenkins. I'm a sophomore here at UT, and I'm a government major, and I'm the president of the University Residence Hall Association. Our organization, since we do govern the students that live within University Residence Halls, we have discussed this in great detail, and we've even registered our opinion with the Capitol, and that we totally do not support handguns on a college campus. Just because we feel that, I mean, no matter if it's in the residence halls or buildings, anywhere on campus, it's considered a home for many students, especially the 7,600 that live on our college campus and thousands more that live on college campuses around Texas. So we feel that any guns at all would threaten that safety that we come to love by living on campus.
You just heard from students at UT Austin who talked to FSRN about the concealed carry bill in the Texas legislature. As summer creeps in, students around the nation are graduating from high school and college. For many, it's a time to celebrate. But for some, graduation is a reminder that they're separate and unequal students simply because of their immigration status. Although people around the world look at the U.S. as a place where hard work will make any dream come true, that's not true for the thousands of youth who came to this nation as children, finished college, but have few rights when it comes to building a life and career in the U.S. Today, FSRN talks to one of these recent grads. 22-year-old Favi recently finished her degree in sociology at UCLA. She remembers crossing the border with her mother when she was just 5 years old, the same way everyone she knew at that time came to the U.S. She attended high school in Los Angeles, then went on to community college before transferring to UCLA, although because of her immigration status, she didn't qualify for financial aid or even loans. In addition to studying, exams, and research papers, Favi had to keep track of all her family's immigration court appearances and even had to do much of the translating for her parents' attorneys or employers. I caught up with Favi, who graduated one quarter early not only because of the exorbitant costs at UCLA for undocumented students, but because she faces a deportation hearing in just a few days.
I'm actually in removal proceedings. My parents and I, we were in the process, and we've been for years, but it takes forever for the court and for interviewing to come up. But it's a very, very complicated issue. But we're in removal proceedings right now. Most likely we will get deported. We've been going to court, and every time we go, they just postpone it. They tell us, we'll come back in 2 months, come back in 4 months. And the last time they're like, come back in 6 months. And every time they do that, I just live in so much uncertainty. I don't know, like, what classes I should take. I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish my degree. I mean, those were the questions that were always on my mind before, like, about a year ago. And I was like, well, if I have court in February and if they deport me, then that gives me 3 months. So that means I have to finish before that time, which means I have to finish school before most students are done. So that means I can't go that last quarter to school because in case anything happens, in case we do get deported, I at least want to get my degree.
That's an incredible amount of pressure. What does it mean to you to be an undocumented student? You basically lack a piece of paper, a status, a document. You're somehow unequal to other students that obviously have it a lot easier than you.
It's very, very hard to be undocumented. But at the same time, I find these challenges push me further to get to my goals. And it's really hard. And I know I couldn't have made it without the support of my family, my friends, and just everyone who I've met who has been supportive, the professors, just everyone in my life, really. And I also know a lot of students, a lot of friends and family who do have that privilege. They have the right. They were born here. They're citizens. And they aren't taking advantage of it. And I always give them pep talks. I'm like, if I was in your shoes, I would be doing so much stuff right now. I mean, you have so many privileges. You have so many things for you that are just sitting there and you could just take advantage of them. I have to fight for them. And it's just, it seems sometimes when I'm at my lowest, it's not even worth it. I'm like, well, why am I even here? If like this country's always denying me, it's always being very negative and always hearing the comments like, go back to your country. The word illegal itself is very just dehumanizing. And it's a very emotional part of myself that gets down. It is hard. But then I hear all the support and my friends and my family who just believe in me. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's why I'm here. And that's why I'm going to continue to be here, you know, and give back to the community, give back to my family, my friends, and for myself as well.
So the last time you were in Mexico was when you were 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, 17 years ago.
Right.
How do you prepare yourself for maybe having to go back?
I do still have some memories of living in Mexico, and I don't know. I'm actually very scared because I've thought about it so many times. It has to be constantly in my mind as an option, as a possibility. And I don't know. I mean, I've already been looking into graduate schools there in Mexico and other countries in Latin America so I can continue pursuing my education and get my master's and my PhD. But it's really scary because I feel that if I go back, a lot of people will think that I'm from here because they haven't seen me in so long. I feel like I'll be rejected there too. And that for me is, I think, the biggest heartbreak, just getting rejected from the United States and then getting rejected from Mexico. This girl I know of, one of my colleagues, she was deported and she went back. It had been like 10 years maybe. And she said, no, people just don't treat you like the same. You're like American now. And so they think that you think you're better than them. So they kind of leave you on the side. And that's my biggest fear, is to be rejected from them, too.
Favi will be heading to immigration court in just a few days. Meanwhile, the House and Senate have once again reintroduced a bill called the DREAM Act that would grant Favi and other students like her a pathway to citizenship. You're listening to FSRN. Thousands of Gulf Coast residents are scrambling to find housing. That's because tomorrow, the government will begin evicting people from FEMA trailers, where many have lived since Hurricane Katrina left them homeless. Tanya Snyder reports.
FEMA's emergency housing program ended May 1st, and FEMA's getting serious about kicking thousands of people out of their trailers this weekend.
Nobody wants to live in a FEMA trailer. You know, I mean, the only thing worse than a FEMA trailer is no place to live.
Irene Nabatoff is the executive director and founder of the Community Center of St. Bernard in New Orleans.
On many, many levels, things have broken down and stalled, and to the point that many people are worse off now than they were immediately after the storm. Their sense of hope is greatly diminished. Their sense of frustration is greatly elevated.
143,000 families were housed in temporary FEMA housing in the wake of the hurricane. About 4,000 of those trailers are still in use nearly 4 years later. Sharon Fletcher of Common Ground Relief in New Orleans says those people haven't been able to find permanent housing for two reasons.
The people who are still in the trailers, it's either one or the other. Either they cannot find housing because they don't have the money, or they do not have the money to fix up their house.
The continuing shortage of rental housing has sent prices through the roof. Homeowner and flood insurance rates in the Gulf Coast region have skyrocketed, too. And for some, it's the deciding factor keeping them from owning their own homes. Some have taken advantage of the Road Home Program, which provides state funding to help people get back into their own homes. But the average payout is about $57,000, and that's not always enough for people to make their storm-damaged homes livable again. Besides, Sharon Fletcher says the paperwork can be overwhelming.
That you are the homeowner, that you do not share it with anyone, because if you do, everyone has to go there and prove their part. You have to have insurance papers, whether you had it or not. You have to have Social Security, birth certificate. You have to have the works. And if you lost that, you have to first go get all that before you can even get there, because these are papers that are required. They're mandatory in order for them to begin to process your application.
Some advocates say the people forced from their homes by Hurricane Katrina deserve UN protections as internally displaced persons. The Brookings Burn Project on Internal Displacement and the Institute for Southern Studies have criticized the federal government for failing to prevent wide-scale displacement and for failing to prevent discrimination against marginalized and vulnerable populations. The groups also say the government failed to keep partisan politics out of the relief effort and failed to guarantee the right of return and reintegration for people forced to leave the area. Jacques Morial of the Louisiana Justice Institute says his group and several others are demanding an extension on the evictions.
We believe that there should be an extension until FEMA and HUD provide adequate and appropriate casework resources to place people in safe and affordable permanent housing. And that has really been the challenge that people who have been forced to live in trailers face.
There have already been three extensions of the eviction deadline, but Morial's group and the Katrina Information Network say that many FEMA trailer occupants are elderly or have disabilities and need more support to find stable housing. They say more time is also needed for homeowners to appeal denials of road home grants or get other rental assistance. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Sri Lanka's government faces fresh allegations today that its army is mostly responsible for the slaughter of more than 20,000 Tamil civilians in the final weeks of the battles with the Tamil Tiger rebels. That's according to the Times UK, which obtained confidential UN documents. The government insists the figures are inflated and is dismissing the charges. FSRN's Pania Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
The new charge comes 2 days after the UN Human Rights Council passed a resolution urging the Sri Lankan government to protect the rights of minorities. But many criticized the resolution of being too weak and failing to demand an investigation into war crimes. The diplomatic victory of the government spurred celebrations in Sri Lanka. A military parade was conducted in the capital, Colombo. Mahinda Samarasinghe is the Minister of Human Rights Affairs. He says the decision of the UN Human Rights Council is an endorsement of Sri Lanka for its protection of human rights.
In Sri Lanka, it's quite evident. The rule of law that prevails in Sri Lanka gives a further guarantee and enhances the quality of the human rights record of our country.
But many international rights organizations are not happy with the UN's decision. Reporters Without Borders says it is an insult to the thousands of Tamil people affected by the war. Navi Pillai is the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights who proposed the resolution in the Geneva meeting. She says she did the right thing to safeguard the deteriorating human rights situation in Sri Lanka.
Very little information came to the world. The international media have been denied access to Sri Lanka. It's a reasonable call that there should be an investigation from all the reports we are receiving of activities that could well amount to human rights violations.
Some governments are also critical of the resolution, including Canada, Britain, and Germany. The Sri Lankan government has strongly denied the allegations made by the Times UK. It says the government troops ceased using heavy weapons since third week of April. The UN said earlier that 6,500 civilians were killed during the last 2 months. Lakshman Hulugalle is a military spokesperson.
This is totally a false story. There was no shelling like that and there is no killing as this is reported. If there were people dead like this, then of course you have to have the bodies, the people have to see all these things. You can't hide this.
The government says the war against the Tamil Tiger rebels is over, but the welfare of almost 300,000 civilians who have been forced to flee their homes is still in question, as well as whether human rights groups will be able to investigate possible war crimes. Ponnaiah Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
And as we wrap up this newscast, I'd like to let listeners know that this is my last time hosting FSRN. The first story I filed with FSRN was in November 2003 from Tijuana and featured maquila workers struggling to organize. I became anchor in 2005. I've had the opportunity to cover many topics, most recently a historical presidential race that led to the election of the nation's first black president, who just this week announced the first Latina nominee to sit on the Supreme Court, quite a difference from the last 8 years of the Bush administration. Over the years, I've had the chance to work with dedicated freelancers on 6 continents and had the privilege of training correspondents in 4 countries. At the end of the day, this newscast is what it is because of the phenomenal work these reporters do around the world. FSRN's editorial team includes some of the best people on the planet to work with. Our headlines editors Jess Burns and Nell Abram never miss a beat and share a ton of ideas and suggestions that improve what we all do. Leanne Caldwell, who I had the pleasure of working with side-by-side quite a bit during this past year, has a keen understanding of national politics and can always answer my national policy questions with lightning speed. By the time you hear my voice on the air, what you hear has been through an astonishing amount of editing and technical producing. That's all made possible by our incredible staffers, Rose Katapchi, Oscar Hernandez, and Puck Lowe in the Bay Area. And the editing side comes from our amazing producers, Vinod Jose and Catherine Comp, who have always kept me on my toes. In fact, I want to take this opportunity to say that Catherine is undeniably the best producer I've ever worked with. To the Bogado and Rivero families in South America, I want to thank them for their incredible support. And to my friends and family here in the U.S., thank you for having my back. Especially to Thein Mori Sandararajan and to the Flores family. To former professors David Tripp and Richard Kamei, your lessons deeply shaped the way I see the world today. I'll be leaving Los Angeles in a few days to begin work made possible by a generous grant from the Nation Institute. Come Monday, your new interim anchor will be Manuel Rueda. He'll be working from Bogota, Colombia. Finally, my deepest gratitude to our many listeners throughout the country and from those who listen online from abroad. Thank you so much for giving me the cherished honor of hosting this incredible program for the past 4 years. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.